what we're going to start lab with today is a completion of the discussion of the calculations for the kinetics experiment, or what I refer to as the iodine clock experiment. So, not to go over all the detail yet again, just to try to summarize it very quickly, there were three reactions involved in this experiment. The first reaction was the one that we were studying in terms of the rate law. So that's the one that had iodide and peroxydisulfate in it. And in parts A and B of this experiment, if we had done it in real life, that is what would have determined that the reaction is first order in both of those reagents. So that's the reaction that we're studying. There's the reaction involving thiosulfate. That's the one that controls how far the reaction goes and therefore brings consistency to how we determine reaction rate. So that doesn't show up in the rate law because that's a separate issue. There's also a third reaction, which is how we visualize when to stop timing the reaction. So this written reaction, the one that we're studying for the rate law, produces triiodide, which is what then turns colors when it hits starch. The purpose of the thiosulfate is to delay that process and delay it by the same amount for each reaction. And so there's our set of three reactions, but it's only the one here that I've written that ends up being related directly to the rate law. Now, as I had said, in parts A and B, we would have determined that this is first order in each of those reagents, and we went through the method of initial rates last time of how to determine that. Now, in part C of the experiment, that's where we are going to try to determine activation energy for this process. So, if you look at the rate law, we have the rate constant little k, which remember, there is an expression for that, the Arrhenius expression, that relates it to activation energy. So I've already done the derivation of it before. So natural log of k is, once you manipulate all this, equal to negative e a over r times 1 over t plus natural log of a. And so we are solving using a graphing method just like we've talked about a couple of times previously in this quarter. By substitution of variables, we will plot natural log of k on the y-axis. We'll plot 1 over t on the x-axis. Oh, sorry, one moment. There we go. Natural log of k, y-axis. 1 over t, x-axis. We will get a graph that has a negative slope to it. And that slope will be equal to negative Ea over r. So this r, by the way, is the same thermodynamic value that we used in a previous lab. So this is 8.314. And when you get to it, temperature must be in Kelvin. So all you have to do, in fact, is create the graph of natural log of k versus 1 over t. How do we solve for k? We get it from the rate law. So we already have that the rate law is equal to k times concentration of iodide times concentration of the peroxydisulfate. But we'd already developed an expression previously where this is equal to a constant, 0.00063, divided by time. And so remember, that's the whole point of using the thiosulfate. It makes the same extent of reaction And so the only variable is time. So that means we know rate, and we know the concentrations. Well, we can get the concentrations. Because just like I discussed last time, when you're running these reactions, you're mixing reagents together, and so you're diluting the different reactants. And so the concentration of iodide used is equal to the volume used divided by the total volume, which is a constant in this case, multiplied by the concentration of the stock solution of iodide. So remember, the stock solutions are listed in the tables in the lab text along with the volumes used. And same exact same calculation we do for the peroxydisulfate, where its concentration that we actually used is equal to the volume used divided by the volume total times the stock concentration of the peroxydisulfate. So you'd solve, and K would be equal to R divided by the product of the concentrations of the two reactants. So just to highlight a little bit here, the 1 over T, that is going to be straight from data. And then the natural log of K, well, that comes from the K that I just showed you, and it's not updating, is it? Hold on. There we go. So you prepare the graph, you get the activation energy, and that's part C. So we've gone over how to do parts A, parts B, part C, and there is no part D, because it would simply be about a catalyst, and it's not terribly exciting, because without the catalyst, it goes slow, and with the catalyst, it goes fast, which is kind of what we expected to do, right? Questions about kinetics, then. So if you weren't in lecture, if you didn't hear the announcement, this lab is not due Wednesday, it is due next week, Wednesday. I'm hoping that with the drum up to the release, with the number of times you've heard about this lab, in just unbearable anticipation, you may all run out and start working on the calculations. That's my little fantasy land, right? So, right next to Tomorrowland. And you got to maybe then have some calculations ready by Wednesday. So if you had any problems, we could spend Wednesday going over in lab. And even next week, if you get it done over the weekend, that means Monday you have a chance to ask questions. But it is due 8:50 in the morning for Section 1, 2:30 in the afternoon on Wednesday the 17th. And I'll talk a little bit more about formatting once you've all started to do the calculation. So maybe on Wednesday I'll talk about how to cook up the lab report.
Professor, for this lab, we just have to do a calculation section, a data table section, and then are we going to be writing any formal report or anything like that?
No formal report, kind of like before, just enough to get the job done.
Excellent.
Someone asked, was the my fantasy land next to Space Mountain? No, it must be Spaced Out Mountain. I keep waiting for Disney lawyers to catch up to my little class. Well, if there's no questions, we're going to move on to the next lab, which I had given you all a heads up in lecture to try to get around to reading it if you had the chance. And this next lab is very appropriate because it is an equilibrium lab. and it is to determine an equilibrium constant. So, not showing the identities of the full reagents at the moment, there are two ions involved, iron 3, and an ion you may not have ever seen before. It is the thiocyanate ion. Cyanate is where you take cyanide and add an oxygen to it. Thio is a prefix meaning sulfur. And so thiocyanate means take cyanate and substitute a sulfur into it. So these two can reversibly form a complex. That is another one of our transition metal complexes. Why is it a transition metal complex? Iron in the center, that is a transition metal. And the thiocyanate binds to the iron. Since the iron was plus 3, the ion that's attaching to it is negative 1. That's why the overall charge of the complex is plus 2. And I said that this is something that's formed reversibly. We can tell that from the reversible arrow that I put there. So if it's something that's reversibly formed, that means there's an equilibrium constant for it. And so that's what the goal of this lab is, to determine the equilibrium constant of this reaction. And I forgot to state it early this morning, so let me state that now. KC, which just means complex, just like another K, it's going to be the concentration of the product, which to make it simpler to squeeze in here, I'll say complex. And then that's divided by the two ion concentrations. Notice this has nice simple one-to-one-to-one stoichiometry, so it has a nice simple equilibrium constant. If this was not one-to-one stoichiometry, a lot more complicated, and I'll touch on that maybe a little bit towards the end of the lab. But this is our goal. Come up with K. Now, how are we going to do this? Well, it turns out that the complex we're able to detect using spectroscopy. So if I can recall our historical lab order, different than what we do now, this was the first experiment where we would perform spectroscopy in. And so just to give you a brief reminder of how it works, just in case you read through the lab procedure, you have some kind of light source, which on the machines that you would have used in real life, whatever that is, they have a big dial on it where you can set the frequency or the wavelength. So, and we're doing visible spectroscopy. Why, I'll get to in just a moment. So you're going to have, you would have had a sample that you prepared in a specialized test tube called a cuvette, which I feel like we must have discussed that before. So that's what will have our sample in it. And then that's going to hit some kind of detector. And there are two different things that that detector could potentially measure. One of them is transmittance, which is exactly what it sounds like. It is the percent of light that passes through a sample. That's it. That passes through a sample. And then we have absorbance, which is what it sounds like. It's the amount of light absorbed. Now, because physics, which I guess I never really understood this part, why, but absorbance has a log relationship to transmittance. That's transmittance when it's in fraction, not percent form. So decimal, not percentage. So let me explain for a moment why we would have been doing UV-Vis spectroscopy. UV-Vis is where we're scanning in the UV or visible ranges of the spectrum. Quite technically, we would have been doing from 370 nanometers to 700 nanometers. So I forget where that lies on the violet versus red axis, but roughly the visible spectrum. Spectroscopy in general, remember, that there's some kind of interaction that goes on between light and the substance. And in many transition metal compounds, many transition metal complexes, electronic transitions between energy levels in the transition metals are what cause absorptions to happen in the visible spectrum. And so that's why a lot of metal-containing substances have bright colors to them. It's because this is a colored complex that we're forming that we're doing UV-Vis spectroscopy, because the whole purpose is to come up with concentration. And it turns out there's a nice, simple, linear relationship between absorbance and concentration. So, if we can use spectroscopy to tell us how much complex that we have, then we could do an ice problem to also calculate how much of the reagents we have left over. Because we can figure out what we started with, how much got consumed to make the complex, and once we have those values, we can come up with K. And that's what we're going to do. Now, in real life, there would have been a process for calibrating the machines. And because I don't know, honestly, if I'm going to ask any lab quiz type questions on how to use the machines, because that's something that's very hands-on. I mean, we can describe a machine and y'all can shake your heads like, yeah, that makes sense. And then because you didn't push the buttons, turn the knobs, it might not really make sense, just to try to be fair. But I'd like to describe the process in case you ever use one of these in a future quarter. Because this thing called a SPEC-20, that's a model of spectrometer that's very widely used. It's very, 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 very durable. That's why it shows up in lab classes, so when it gets mistreated and thrown around, it'll still work. And the way that the thing calibrates is this. You have what's called dark current, which is the 0% transmittance mode, and you have to tell the machine what 0% transmittance is. And let me explain what I mean by this. Dark current means how much electricity ends up flowing through whatever sensors there are when there is actually no light that's hitting the detector. So there's always an electric current going through these circuits, and some level of current or voltage, some aspect of that system, is still going to be non-zero, even when the detector's turned off. I mean, when the light source is turned off. In fact, in these models that you use would use in class, if there's no sample in there, there's a window that shuts to keep the light source turned off. So you set the machine up with nothing in it, and then you measure at that wavelength that you want to detect at, just so you can calibrate the machine and say, hey, this is zero transmittance. So if you read through the procedure, then that's what it talks about, fixing 0% transmittance. Now, on the flip side, you don't just have this complex that's forming. You have a solution, which you have water as a solvent, and I believe it's nitric acid that's also in the background. And what if one of those substances absorbs light besides the complex? Well, then we want to be able to detect the complex separately from whatever the solution might be doing. And so what we can do is we can be sneaky. We can create a solution that's not truly a solution, meaning we don't put the starting materials in to make the complex. And so we can read what the nitric acid, the water, the other things present, we can read what they do to respond. And we set the machine then to call that 100%. Maybe there's some light absorbed, but again, that's because of the solution there. So we just let the light pass through, see what comes out, and then we tell the spectrometer, okay, that's 100%. Then we can go measure our sample. And from the signal that you get from the sample, you automatically have adjusted for whatever the solution might do. So because this may not be specifically in a lab quiz question, but because I talked about it, I'd like to go ahead and put it in the notes. So at any one frequency, or let's call it wavelength, because that's the way that the lab discusses it, 0% and 100% transmittance are first established. By calculating or calibrating the spectrometer when no light passes through, and then by measuring a blank sample. To account for any behavior of the solvent. All right, so that would have been how we would calibrate the machine. Now let's talk about the results we get. And because this historically was the first experiment in spectroscopy we did, we typically had people do a little extra work than might what otherwise be needed. And here's what I'm trying to say. If in theory you had done the green salt experiment, you were going to measure one of the concentrations of ions in solution in that lab also by doing spectroscopy. And you might have remembered me saying that there's a particular wavelength that is best to scan at because that's where the compound is most sensitive. Well, in this experiment, historically being first in our spectroscopy experiments, you would have prepared exactly that graph where at every wavelength, you measure the absorbance to figure out where is the sample most sensitive. So again, according to the procedure, you would have measured from 370 to 700 nanometers, and that would be our wavelength, lambda, in, again, nanometers. And to idealize the curve a bit, it would look something like this. Now, the top of this is called a peak. And I feel like I might have already told this little story already, but just want to remind you because English is a horrible language sometimes, at least as far as spelling and pronunciation go. So especially when you throw some of the more exotic English accents in. Like if I was to let my southern accent out of the box, which happens whether I wanted to or not if I'm back in that area for an extended period of time. And let's say that I really overdid it, like hammed it up. Then when you pronounce certain words, it could be difficult to tell what I'm saying. For example, if you were going to fix into cooking yourself something, then you might be using a frying pan. If you're writing something, it might be a writing pan. And you got to fix something, it might be a safety pan. So what I just said was pan, pan, and pan. Or in more proper English, pan, pen, and pin. So I make fun of myself only for the reason that you shouldn't be feeling bad about if you don't hear the word correctly for peak. Because every year I get lab reports where it's spelt P-I-C-K, pick. Because those I sounds in English are very close for listeners of other languages. So long story of saying, get the right vocab word. It's peak as in the mountain peak.
What's on the y-axis?
Very good. I did forget to put it there because I got off of telling that story. So this is the spectrum, just to give us some context. And A is for absorbance. Now, there is a wavelength at which this reaches its maximum sensitivity. And so that's what we call the lambda max. So that is the wavelength the sample responds to most strongly. And that's why it's what we use to determine the concentration. Because if we're going to look for something, why would we look for it where it is weakest? We would look for where the sample is the most interactive, easiest to detect. And then that's where this popularly named Beer's Law comes in. Which is a very simple expression, as I had stated before. Linear has three variables in it. So this first, or last one I'll start with, actually, that is path length. Which is exactly what it sounds like. It's the distance light travels through the sample. And this experiment, it turns out to be 1.00 centimeters. Now C is for concentration. Which is what we're eventually going to solve for. Epsilon, or E, that is what's known as the extinction coefficient. And that represents how sensitive the sample is to light. In this case, epsilon is known. It's 6120, has units of inverse meter, or no, not meters, inverse molarity, inverse centimeters. Now, it suddenly struck me, and I don't know why it never had really made me think before. If you already know the extinction coefficient because they give it to you in lab, there really is no reason to generate the graph like what I demonstrated up above, except for it being a lesson in spectroscopy. So that's why in your green salt lab, you didn't see any graph like that because you were just given the epsilon value and the wavelength that you were supposed to use. So, we solve for concentration, and that is equal to absorbance divided by epsilon times L, just rearranging the equation up above. Since L is 1 and epsilon is known, it's just A divided by 6120. And then, well, then we're supposed to solve for the equilibrium constant. So I wasn't able to do it fast enough this morning. I was trying to do technology and just was slowing down. So in your book, there is a table that looks something vaguely like this. We have two solutions labeled A and B, and they represent the iron 3 reagent and the thiocyanate. So we have solutions that range from 1 to 9. And for example, one of the solutions, number 2, uses 1.0 milliliters of the iron 3 and then 2.50 milliliters of the thiocyanate solution. We know the original concentrations they're given to us in the lab text, but just like in the previous lab, that means we have to do a dilution calculation. So the iron 3 concentration in fact used is equal to the volume used divided by the volume total times the stock iron concentration. Let me rewrite that. So the thiocyanate, identical style calculation, volume used over the stock volume. No, not stock volume. Oh my goodness. Total volume is what we divide by. There we go. And then we multiply by the stock concentration. So those are our concentrations that we would have started with. So let me now switch over to talking about the ice problem we would solve. So the reaction again involves the iron 3 ion and the thiocyanate ion. Those are reactants. Our product is iron thiocyanate. Of course, we don't have any complex to start with, but initially, we will have some calculated initial concentration of iron, and we will have some initial calculated concentration of thiocyanate. Now, since the stoichiometry is 1 to 1 to 1 to 1, that means this is going to go down by x, both the reagents, and then the product will go up by x. And so, to simplify, we have a known quantity. Well, okay, we don't know that yet. I'm jumping ahead too fast. So we have iron 3 initial minus x, thiocyanate initial minus x and x. But if I could highlight on the previous page here, C for concentration. And let me highlight that that is the concentration of the complex formed. Well, then over here, That's exactly what X is. Which means that X is determined by spectroscopy. Once you can...
The screen is frozen.
Oh, dear. There we go. So I was saying that X, that's the value of the complex. That's what's determined by spectroscopy. So that means we know how to calculate all these values. That means all we need to do now is substitute and solve for K. So this is going to be another lab where you would want to use a spreadsheet because you're going to be calculating multiple equilibrium constants using the same formulas but different initial concentrations. You should get the same equilibrium constant each time because it doesn't matter how much you start with in terms of what kind of equilibrium you're going to end up with. Now there is a side topic I would briefly like to discuss because older version of this lab didn't leave it quite so obvious that the complex forms in 1:1:1:1:1 stoichiometry. So what I'm now drawing is not a reaction progress diagram. This is not showing the percentage of reactants versus percentage of products. This is showing how much of each of two different reactants were used in one particular chemical reaction. So we have these two reagents that the procedure simplifies to labels A and B. A is the iron 3, B is the thiocyanate. If we look at the absorbance of the complex formed, it turns out we do hit a maximum value when we have a 50-50 mixture of the two substances. Now, why does this matter? So, if you look at the data set where you look at the table reagents, all the reagents, total volumes are all the same. That will work out to meaning that you have the same total ion concentration in solution. Now, equilibrium can happen even if you have a limiting reagent type of problem. Meaning, suppose that a reaction's reversible, and you don't have the right concentrations to exactly cause the reaction to happen. Meaning, you don't quite have reaction stoichiometry. It'll still reach equilibrium. But there could be a limit of how much product you form, the total quantity versus the percentage. So in this case, because the complex has a 1-to-1 structure to it, it has its maximum absorbance at 50-50 mixture if the mixture has a fixed total number of ions. Because if your complex is 50-50 percentage makeup, half of it A, half of it B, just number-wise, in terms of limiting reagent, you'd want to have equal quantities of A and B around. Exactly the situation that happened in this lab. So, let me write some of that down, what I just said, which is the fact that the maximum absorbance occurs when the reaction starts with equal concentration of ions. because the complex is formed with one-to-one stoichiometry. And the part that makes it tricky is that it also depends on, there's a fixed total number of ions. So that really is it as far as covering this lab. I'm going to probably make the report for this due during finals week. So it means not this upcoming week, but even more, one more week after that. So does anyone have any questions about this equilibrium lab? Our next lab that we're going to discuss is about indicators. Does anybody know anything about indicators? Can give me some form of definition. Salts. There may be salts that could be indicators. But there's, it's a different kind of definition than just saying it's a salt. pH. It can be related to pH, what an indicator is. An acid or a base. But it's more specific than that. It's an acid or base that dramatically changes colors. Depending on pH. So pH is related. So yes, someone is typing, the indicators generally are used or frequently used in titrations. They don't have to be the only thing that they get used for, but that's one common place for them. And in fact, next quarter, you'll learn how to determine what the proper indicator is, depending on what kind of titration that you're doing. So if I can just share a quick image here. I want to pull up some colors of different indicators. And so this is taken from just a website that I believe is it looks like it's been passed around the net. Well, let me share this. So here it says pH indicator chart. It's got a pH scale from left to right, from 1 to 14 or 0 to 14, so really acidic to really basic. And if you look down towards the bottom of the page, it is phenolphthalein that is probably the indicator that you're most familiar with. Now, you were told probably a small lie related to it, which is that phenolphthalein is clear in acidic solutions and pink in basic solutions. That's mostly true, but you notice if you look very carefully, the region of the pH range where phenolphthalein is clear includes from roughly 7 to 8, which means ever so slightly basic. So that's why it's not a 100% accurate statement to say that phenolphthalein is pink only in basic solutions. But in the labs where we use it, it does change color at the right point. And so, like I said, this is a topic for next quarter, learning how to choose an indicator that's right for your purpose. Now, the indicator we're going to be using in class today would be using, I gotta remember that, it would be bromocresol green, which is number 5 counting down from the top of this chart. And in case you're not looking at the same chart that I happen to find, bromocresol green does turn green at some point from roughly pH 4 to pH 5. And then it's yellow when it's more acidic than that and blue when it's less acidic than that. And it's kind of the proverbial yellow plus blue makes green, as I'm going to discuss in a minute. Now take another look at the chart here and realize that all of these indicators have a range that is about 1 or 2 pH units wide, and it's where the color is transitioning from one form to another. So we don't quite have the math developed to have an in-depth discussion, but there is a way to justify why it's pretty much 1 or so units wide that this range occurs. So anyway, there's your set of indicators. Now, let me show you the structure for bromocresol green. Since I've already got the web shared here. And looking at this image from Wikipedia. So this is the structure of bromocresol green, which may be hard for you to make much sense of. The important thing to note is that the compound on the left is charge neutral. It is not a cation or an anion. And then it does lose a proton, so it is an acid its own self. And then it ends up forming an ion that is very, very heavily delocalized. So you might remember a little bit earlier in the quarter, we talked about bonding. I was going to have to sleeze there. We talked about bonding, and we saw systems that can't be represented by one structure alone because the bonding is spread out across the molecule. And the term I use to describe that is delocalization. Other people would say resonance. Well, in this picture that you're looking at currently, which is, again, on Wikipedia if you wanted to go look at it later, you have two different structures that look almost identical to each other, but they're resonance structures of each other. That charge is delocalized across the entire molecule. Why do I point that out? Because that happens in other biologically important molecules, this heavy delocalization, where every atom is involved in some way or another, practically, with a double bond. So I now take us to the substance carotene to take a look at its molecular structure. And again, you notice that there's a large sequence of carbons that all are part of a double bond chain. So each carbon in that chain has a double bond. Well, that means that electrons very easily get delocalized across that whole system. And the reason that matters is that when you have organic molecules like this that heavily delocalize that charge, that creates energy levels that are the right gap where absorbance occurs in the visible spectrum. So that's why these compounds interact with light. You might know, some of you, that carotene effectively gets incorporated, something like it, into molecules that might be used in sight, in light perception. So these conjugated organic systems are important molecules. Now, like I said, this is carotene we're looking at currently. And I point that out because I recall a story earlier this morning that my mom told me, and this apparently really is true, where you might know, if you have brothers and sisters that were younger than you, that getting a kid to eat is not always the easiest task. And so if a parent discovers something that the kid's crazy about, it's like 100 bottles of that right there. Let's feed it until they're bored of it. And apparently, I just couldn't get enough of carrots when I was a kid. Well, carotene, come from carrots, is this orangish color. And apparently, I ate so many carrots that I got keratinosis, which means my nose turned orange. which I don't remember if my mom has any pictures from that time period or not. And this is when I was a little kid. So I even as a little kid remember the story. It's like, she's messing with me. And you know, apparently it's true. Apparently it's not harmful. It's just that it takes a while for it to work out of your system. But anyways, that was a little bit of a side story, talking about structures that related to bromocresol green, which, one more picture before we turn off the share parade here. Now looking at Wikipedia again, we're looking at a series of solutions all prepared, supposedly, from bromocresol green at a range of different pHs. So that shows it's yellow versus green versus blue color, quote-unquote, in real life. I love it when teachers use the number one resource we are told not to use. If this were a political science class, I would just throw the words fake news out there and just see what happens. But, you know, this is not a political science class, so I'm going to stop this share now. And let's return back to the iPad. Okay, so I went on a long aside to tell you what indicators of substances are. So, an indicator is something that is sensitive to pH. And in this particular experiment, bromocresol green is used. Which becomes yellow in acidic media, which means a pH less than 4, and blue in more basic media, which in this case means a pH greater than 5. So it's yellow in acidic media, blue in more basic media, and just edit this slightly, and green in between, which I've been told is... Well, it's not easy being green. So let me write this out in a reaction style, because bromocresol green, in its one form where it has the hydrogen, is yellow. So let me highlight that yellow. And then the indicator can act like an acid. So it releases a hydrogen, and the release of that hydrogen causes a structural change to occur, which is why it changes colors to blue. Now, from a chemical perspective, what is the relationship between these two substances? Yes, they're indicators, but there's something else. Actually, they're not indicators. It's an indicator that has two different forms. What is the relationship between these two forms? And as the internet is experiencing food coma, or maybe brain coma, I will indicate that these are conjugates of each other. So the yellow form would be called the acid conjugate, the one that has the proton, and the blue form is the base conjugate. Now, there's a special situation we try to create in this experiment, and I'll tell you how in just a moment. But let's assume somehow or another, half of the acid or the acidic indicator has been neutralized and converted into its conjugate base. So if we start out with half of the acid and get rid of it, half of it's still going to be in the acid form. Half of it now is going to be in the conjugate base form. So those two concentrations of the two forms of the indicator will be equal. Well, and just like the old ads used to say, yellow plus blue makes green. That's what's going to be green. Now, let's say that really is true, that you have equal quantities of the two of these things in solution somehow. So, the equilibrium expression for this indicator, based off of the reaction that's up above here, and let me refer back to that reaction so you know where I got it from, products would be H+, and instead of A-, we're calling it indicator, so that's why it's In-. And that's divided by how much of the indicator is still in its acid form. Now, what if the acidic and basic form of the indicators really were equal in concentration, just like what I highlighted right above? Well, that means that this is going to cancel, and so we could write this expression in two ways. We could say K indicator is equal to just the H plus concentration, or the way that it's more frequently expressed, is that the pK of the indicator is equal to pH. So it is circled in green here. Both of these represent strength, which means acid strength, of the indicator. And this last equation is the one most frequently used, the way it's most frequently expressed. So, all we have to do is find the solution where the concentrations of the conjugates are equal and figure out what the pH is. The way we're going to figure out the pH is we force it to be something by using what is known as a buffer, which buffers really are a topic of 1C, but I want to introduce the topic, so we won't go very in-depth into this, but I'll give you an introduction. So an ideal buffer is a mixture of equal moles of a weak acid and its conjugate base. Now, example, an easy one, would be acetic acid and acetate. Now, what's so special about a buffer? It's not the acid, acetic acid or acetate or whatever the buffer identity is that matters. It's the fact that it resists changes to pH. So some of you might know from your biology class that the body has a carbonate-bicarbonate system that it uses, in order to regulate blood pH. And you might further know that if blood pH changes by an entire pH unit, that would just almost certainly be lethal. So a lot of biochemical reactions depend on having a very regulated environment. In studying biochemistry, we often want to create solutions that have a specific pH so that we can observe how things behave. And so then we would design a buffer with the right pH, and that's another topic you learn about next quarter. So the purpose of using buffers in general is that buffers resist changes in pH. Due to the addition of small quantities of acid or base. And that's because if you added acid, you have the base conjugate that could react. If you added base, you have the acid conjugate that could react. Now, let me show you very quickly a little bit of math that you're going to see next quarter to show, one, how you can easily calculate buffer pH in certain circumstances, but also want to explain why this ideal buffer is a mixture of equal moles. It's kind of the same trick we pulled just a minute ago using a Ka expression. Using a general Ka expression where Ka is equal to H plus times A minus over HA, let's take the negative base 10 log of both sides of the equation. So we get negative base 10 log of Ka is equal to negative base 10 log of this mess, which is a product inside of a log. Well, you might remember that products in logs can be separated into two different logs. So this turns into negative base 10 log of Ka is equal to negative base 10 log of H plus minus the negative base 10 log of the ratio of the base and acid conjugate concentrations. Well, negative base 10 log of Ka is pKa. Negative base 10 log of H plus is pH. And then we still have this minus the base 10 log of the ratio of the concentrations. Rewriting it to solve for pH, we get that pH is equal to pKa plus the base 10 log of the base concentration divided by the acid concentration. And these are the concentrations of the conjugates. And this equation is known as the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. So, when the acid and base conjugates are equal in concentration, just like the situation with the indicator I was talking about earlier, that's exactly the pH at which that the solution has a pH equal to the pKa. So there's a direct relationship between the acid strength and pH. As long as that balance of acid and base conjugates doesn't change, then pH doesn't change. Now, I referred to humans having a conjugate buffer system. If you were to go swimming in a boiling bucket of sulfuric acid, no, that conjugate system's not going to keep you from reacting with the acid. There's a limit how far buffers can be pushed. And in fact, that's something known as a buffer capacity. But now, bringing it back to the lab, if we use... And I forgot what the two substances are without looking. I think it's disodium phosphate and citric acid, but I'm going to have to go back and look. But if we use these pre-prepared solutions that that have buffers in them, we can create all different pHs, pH 4, 5, 6, 6.5, 7, whatever we want. And that's exactly what you would have done in this experiment. You mix a series of buffer solutions together, preparing a range of solutions with pHs, and then you drop the indicator into each one. It's going to be one of the ones where it's green that we're interested in. But there's an even more mathematical way to go about this, but I don't have time to explain that today. But at least I've introduced the major concepts in this lab, at least touched on what a buffer solution is, because we're going to talk about them when we run through this lab again. Went through the spectroscopy in the previous lab to talk about relationship to concentration. Where I'm going to go next time is to link spectroscopy to this lab as well, because we want to determine where the concentrations in the acid and conjugate are equal, and we do that using spectroscopy.